Kia ora and welcome to this episode of Better Off Red. I'm Pip. Thank you so much for listening in. We're back. Woohoo! We've been away for a while, taking care of business. Well, the business of swimming and enjoying the sunshine in Wellington. Gosh, what a summer. Awesome. So yeah, we are back. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. We're also on Podbean. And also we have a website, which is betterrednz.wordpress.com. So that's betterrednz. Red is R-E-A-D, like reading a book. Get it? Awesome. So yeah, we are back and excited and rearing to go, and we have an episode for you. And I talked to Simon Sweetman, who is a Wellington writer, about a book by Leonard Cohen. It's a 1993 book called Stranger Music. So what this book does is compiles some of Cohen's published poetry and also quite a few of the lyrics to his songs. So it's this amazing mix of I think there's also some of Beautiful Loser in there as well, like some novel excerpts sort of collected as sort of prosy poems, which is quite cool too. So we had a great chat about this book. During the week before we had this, I went to my bookcase and realized I have quite a few Leonard Cohen poetry books. So at some stage I have gone through a huge Leonard Cohen poetry phase, which is murking into, I can't remember when that was. I think it was in my teen years. I'm not sure. Anyway, yay Leonard Cohen. Simon is an amazing writer, and he does, among other things, a blog called Off the Tracks. So there is a blog called Off the Tracks, and also, cunningly, there is his reviewing on Stuff and the Dominion Post, which is called Blog on the Tracks. So you can read him in a few places, but a good place to start is Off the Tracks blog. Simon also wrote a book which we talk about, which is called On Song. It was published in 2013 and is a book where each chapter is a song. Songs like She Speeds, songs like How Bizarre, New Zealand songs, and he talks to the people that wrote them about how they might have been written. And it got me back into Don McGlashan. Gosh, by crikey, the Martin Birds. Wow. But also everyone else. It's a really good book. Anyway, without further ado, here is the episode, and thanks for listening. Et je lisais les lignes de ta main. Tu as tué mon âme de gitan. Et je t'en veux, t'en loue en même temps. Adieu, Marianne. Le temps vient, nous allons rire, pleurer et rire, pleurer, puis en rire à nouveau. Okay, so I am here with Simon Sweetman. Hello, Simon.
Hi.
Thanks for coming around.
Yeah, cool.
It's awesome. We are going to be talking about Stranger Music, which is a collection of poems and songs by Leonard Cohen. And I don't know, can you remember when you first bumped into this book?
Yeah, not quite exactly, but, kind of. I was a teenager. I reckon I was about 13 or 14. So I just saw it in a bookstore, and I knew Leonard Cohen and listened to him a little bit, but not actually that much. And I just liked the idea that there was this, and I knew that he, you know, had... I knew enough about him at that point that he'd written before he'd recorded music, but I really didn't know much, and I just liked the idea that here was this quite big book, you know, fairly sizable for a collection of lyrics. And so I just kind of decided then and there that I not only wanted to get it, but I kind of wanted to like it, you know. Yeah. Like I kind of went, this is something I'm going to work at. And I found it really easy to like, you know. I took it home and read it, and kind of read it through in not quite one sitting, but nearly. Like I can remember the weekend that I got it, and just sort of making excuses to go back to my room and read a few more pages, and sort of, you know, being called for dinner and hiding out. And so, yeah, and I just kind of like, I read it a bunch of times, and then I lost a copy of it and bought another copy when I moved to Wellington for university. I remember seeing it one of the first visits to Unity Books when it was in the smaller location, and I was buying, I was going in there sort of for weekly visits and buying Bukowski books mostly, because they had the full range, and you know, growing up in Hawke's Bay, you couldn't find those things. But I bought a second copy of it, and I've bought it two or three times for gifts for people, and I just kind of just keep going back to it. So it's always been, and I think it's been like it was a bit of a gateway drug to reading other books of lyrics.
Yeah,
you know, like to that, and the Bob Dylan collection of lyrics is a big one for me. And you know, I'll even read collections of lyrics that I wouldn't say I'm not a fan of the songwriter, but just maybe sometimes the lyrics don't stand up on the page. A good example for me is probably about 15 years ago they published a book of Neil Finn's lyrics, and Neil Finn, I don't think many people would argue that he's not a good songwriter. I love Neil Finn as a songwriter, but I really didn't feel the lyrics on the page meant anything or worked. Whereas Paul Kelly, his lyrics on the page I think are extraordinary.
And what can you talk about a little bit about this project of putting lyrics on the page? Like I don't know, I think we sort of talked about it, and I said why would we do that?
People think it's a strange thing, I guess, and I always kind of quote the, there's a line in Paul Kelly's book in the intro where he sort of says it's a very odd thing to do, to separate words and music, because they're kind of two tools for a songwriter that they maybe, if not equally, they're both important components. And he says something like, if the music is doing its job, it charges the weak lines, it obscures the weak lines and it charges the good ones. And he says it's slightly better than that. But I always sort of like that. That's kind of been my, ever since reading that, that's kind of been, sits in the back of my mind whenever I try to analyse what makes a song good, if I'm thinking about the lyrics. And it's interesting, like writing, the blog about music every day, I quite often try to mention something about lyrics, and I'm always quite dismayed when I read people going, "Yeah, I don't care about lyrics. I just like the song." And I think, well, that is a fair enough, motivation towards music. And I certainly love lots of instrumental music and lots of kind of, I guess, funk music where the lyrics are certainly not profound. they are just a bit of fun. And of course also there's some great political funk music, you can't say that they don't ever matter. But yeah, I don't know what it is with me. I guess I listen in for lyrics, so I'm interested in it. There is something quite fascinating about reading them on the page. I remember reading Joni Mitchell's book of poems and lyrics, and I was already in love with her music, but when I first read the lyrics, I wasn't that interested in them only on the page, because I think with her it was about how she fits them to music, because there's some quite complicated stories going on. But then that's become a favourite book. You know, I go back to that now and read that, and I'm sort of, now I can, I guess because I know the music a bit better, now I can kind of go, wow, this is an idea on its own. You know, as a lyric, and then the fact that she married it up to, and her some quite complex music, is kind of amazing. So, yeah, I guess for me, I just kind of like, and I've always been interested in, I've always been a kind of reader of poetry, and so I sort of see song lyrics. You know, I can read them on the page as if they're a poem, and in many cases, and obviously Leonard Cohen is a great example, they are, or they were, like a lot of his. What's interesting to me is going through the years and going back to this book and going back through his music from time to time, sort of seeing the, you know, he's always treated writing so seriously as a craft and a job. Some musicians end up falling into that, but not many start that way. Most musicians start off, you know, jamming in a garage or something, and then they become a good lyricist with time. You know, like Paul McCartney and John Lennon is a good example. Yeah. They just love making rock and roll records. They love listening to rock and roll records, and then they found they had some, you know, profound things to say with lyrics as they went on. But Leonard sort of did that first, and then, you know, he was listening to music and he was interested in making music, but that sort of seemed to come secondary to what he had to say on the page. And you listen to the songs, and you know, in some cases there are unreleased versions of songs where there's, you know, 15 verses but he only recorded 7.
Yeah.
You know, Hallelujah is a great example of that.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many, there's probably too many cover versions of Hallelujah now, but some of them include some of the different lyrics that you don't hear in other versions. I don't know, I'm kind of a bit of a nerd for that stuff. I just find that all pretty interesting.
Yeah, I feel the same way. It was interesting because Tallulah was running around this morning singing Milkshake.
Speaking of profound lyrics.
Profound, yeah. But I was just thinking how, you know, like I was a kid that, a teenager who, embarrassing, like, I remember one year covering my bedroom walls with white paper and writing Violent Femme lyrics all over the
yeah.
place, and they really always seemed extremely important to me. And yeah, I'm just wondering, yeah,
I used to handwrite lyrics out, you know, handwrite them
yeah.
out, and I used to you know, pause rewind on the tape, and then sometimes you struck lucky and you open up the tape jacket and the lyrics were there, or
yes.
I had recorded I'd made a dubbed copy of the record that was in the lounge, and
yep.
so I'd go and find Mum and Dad's record, and, you know, there was a lyric sheet, so I sort of cut the middleman out and started writing out the lyrics from and putting them up on the wall, and I had a folder of them, and I'd
yep.
alternate them, you know, favourites, you know, Pink Floyd lyrics and
yep.
David Bowie lyrics and Tracy Chapman lyrics,
yep.
yeah, all sorts of weird and wonderful and different things. And then I remember my dad won a typewriter and you know, a flash at the time, electronic typewriter in a sales competition or something, and he thought I might like it, and so I started, you know, typing out these lyrics, which in some cases I'd already handwritten, and my handwriting's always been appalling. So I started typing them out and putting them on the walls, and you know, I guess by that point I'd started trying to write poems myself, and so I typed them out, and I've still got folders full of that stuff,
yeah.
and it was all it sounds thoroughly obsessive, and it was, because I was doing that, you know, while, you know, the whole time there was music playing, and
yes.
it might not have been the music that I was in my mind transcribing, you know, by writing out these lyrics, but there was something going on in the background that I was listening to, and, you know, I'd make it through one side of a tape, flip it over, when that was finished a new tape would go on, and I could spend sort of, you know, hours doing that.
it sounds like our lives were very similar. That sounds really familiar. Like, I was just thinking, and I was just wondering, it's quite interesting because sometimes I'll be writing and I'll think this sounds familiar or feels familiar, and I think that a lot of my writing was through that copying out.
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
what I mean? Like, I was just thinking about that Bonnie Tyler song, Holding Out for a Hero.
Yeah.
Like, I remember thinking that was the most beautiful and tragic and epic kind of thing.
What's
and
that
remember,
great? Is it, what's that, is it The Squid and the Whale, that film
yes.
where he performs Hey You by
yes,
Pink Floyd and says,
yes.
and they sort of say that's a Pink Floyd song or whatever, and he's all, no, but I felt I could have written it. I love that film, but I really identified with that moment. I was like, you know, I'd be writing out these lyrics and going, I could have written this, you know,
yeah.
and I couldn't have. But
and it is so interesting because I was just thinking, like, that was so my friend. Like, I had friends and I hung out with people, and often we would, you know, but I was just thinking so much of this is done in public. Like, I'm thinking of, oh, it's called Genius, isn't it? Is that what it's called, where people have annotated lyrics, and, you know, like, I just feel like everything's done quite communally now, but I remember that being a very soul task. It wasn't like I was then going to a group where we would read out our lyrics.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's funny, because I'm just thinking now, like, you know, you think you could have done this, or you think when you're writing something, and, you know, writing these lyrics and listening to these songs, so you're so focused, and then when you go to do some writing, you think, you know, you're obviously treading across similar themes. But I remember, you know, as a teenager, the first time I tried to write a song, I was staying with a friend in Gisborne, and we were obsessed with the, you know, again, we were teenagers, and we were obsessed with the very early Rolling Stones.
Oh, yeah.
Well, all periods of the Rolling Stones,
yeah.
but we'd sort of worked our way back from the 80s.
Awesome.
And so we, at this time, we were like loving, and we were looking for the sort of more obscure, I guess, at the time for us, album tracks. And so I had this compilation, and there's this really great song from the late late 60s from the Stones called Citadel, and it's sort of where they get kind of mildly psychedelic, you know. It's off Satanic Majesty's Request, so it's when they're sort of locked in a battle with the Beach Boys and the Stones to try and, you know, Sergeant Pepper's the one everyone sort of remembers in Pet Sounds, and the Stones made this really good album that people don't sort of put on the same pedestal. Anyway, I remember he had this really cool at his parents' house, they had this really cool garden, and they had this kind of stone sort of monument and like this old washed out creek, and we decided, well, that we didn't really know what a citadel was, but we just it was a cool word, and we decided that this place in their yard, I can't fucking believe I'm saying this, but we decided that this place was the citadel, and that was our inspiration, and we were going to go and write a song, and he went down with his guitar, and I went down with bongo drums and a you know, refill and a pen, and we sat there for about an hour, and all we came up with was one line that I wrote about something to do with moss that I can't remember the line, but it was awful, one line, and he came up with a riff which we then went back to the house and realised he'd just taught himself the riff to Layla by Derek and the Dominoes. Now that was I think I sort of pinpointed that and went, no, that's actually just Layla. And then he was like, no, it doesn't, listen, he's playing it over and over. And then I went and found the Cream of Eric Clapton tape and I said, no, that's Layla. Didn't write a song for about 15 years, you know. So it's not actually that easy. Like, you're building up all this stuff thinking that, you know, I could do that, and you can't.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's so great about one song, the book that you've written. Like, I've got a bit, I really love the chapter on She Speeds, you know, where it's kind of like, well, I was listening to this, and there's a bit of Jimi Hendrix, and there's a little, and I didn't really know the Birds, but I like this cover of them, and I love the way that book works, because it kind of, you get to sort of capture the creative mind at work, and you sort of think to yourself, yeah, I couldn't have done it, you know, like, and, you know, I get to just sit here and sort of, you know, thingy in it.
Well, I was really lucky with that, because most of the people that wrote the songs that I liked, that I wanted to write about, most of them were, you know, good with their time and willing to participate, but not only that, they were either very good liars or they actually genuinely enjoyed the process one way or another. And it was like, I met some of them face to face, some of them we talked on the telephone, one of them I think we did on Skype, and a lot of them were done via email or a phone call to begin with, and then a follow up email, or a face to face and then a follow up email, and some of the people were just so good at writing themselves. Shane Carter is a great example, and the other one I think in that book is Hamish Kilgore, talking about anything. And I talked to both the Kilgores, and I thought it was really lovely. David gave one line answers in email that were perfect, and Hamish sent I think it was about 2,500 words with no punctuation, you know, like a beat poem, like a giant sort of Dylan-esque rant, and both sets of answers were perfect, and both to me sort of explained and their personalities and the different things they brought to the band and the different things that they saw from the song. And so I tried to kind of weave bits of both of them into the book, and I remember going back to Hamish and saying, you know, this is so great what you've written, I'm gonna need to punctuate it, but can I publish the whole thing as a guest blog, because I'm gonna use obviously lots of it in the book, but it's so extraordinary, and I think people will dig it, and I really think you know, I'm not just saying this, it's one of the my favorite things I've kind of published was being able to put his words up like that. I, you know, probably only got a dozen comments or something, but I just know the sort of vibe of that was great, like people loved that, and a lot of people responded to it. Well, you know, it's cool to hear this guy's voice, and you know, I hope he, you know, I'm sure he's working on some version of it, but it'll be really great to get some sort of memoir from him at some point, because to me that was one of the most rewarding experiences of doing that book, was getting to find out where these people's heads were at, you know. And also, like, you know, they're not really that different to me or you or anyone else. They're massive music fans, you know, that was, they're massive writing fans, you know, they're interested in you know, to sit with Dave Dobbin and talk to him for 3 hours was amazing, because I've been a fan since I was sort of 4 or 5 years old, but much as we talked about his career and things he did, it was really great talking, you know, he would just suddenly sort of announce, there were things I couldn't put in the book because they weren't on topic, you know, they weren't on song, but they were so cool. Like, he just talked for about 25 minutes about Brian Eno and David Byrne's My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, and how push comes to shove, it's his favourite album and he wants to make an album like that. And I thought, people would love knowing that about Dave Dobbin, because a lot of people wouldn't instantly spot that, but then people that know his musical mind and know how good he is, you know, they can see why he'd be drawn to an album like that. Mm. And also, your first response is just, fuck, I love that album too. You know, it's exciting to, those are the conversations you have with other people, you know, friends at school, friends at university, friends all through life. You know, now you have them with people you don't actually meet. You just type back and forth across Twitter and other platforms, and you say, oh, I love that too. And, you know, and I discovered this then. So to sort of be involved in those conversations was really cool.
Because I think that's something that excites me most about the work that you do, is that it does seem to capture that conversation. You know, like the blog often has guest people. Yeah. The book itself sort of feels like one of those great conversations.
Yeah, I'm just a facilitator in that book, really. You know, like I
went round. There's some very good writing in it, Simon.
Well, yeah, thanks. But, you're talking about the blurb, I imagine, that I didn't do, and the...
I just think
the subtitle that I didn't come up with, and that sort of thing. No, but I genuinely, you know, as I say, like it was a nice project to. It was a hard project in many ways, and it arrived at a interesting time in my life, because I'm a sort of, even though I write a lot and I guess I work a lot, I do like a lot of writers, I'm sure you do sort of put things off until there's a deadline, I didn't really do, you know, I had this extreme deadline, because I'd signed the contract on this book, and I'd done that, I think, just after finding out that we were going to have a kid. And I was like, great, well, that's the deadline, you know, I need to get this shit done. And then everyone started telling me that. And then, you know, months went by, and I had the list of songs, and I had the list of people I was going to talk to and stuff, but I hadn't really done anything, and I hadn't done anything at all in terms of writing. And then I met with my editor, and he was like, how's it going? And I was like, good. And he's like, so what have you done? And I was like, well, I've thought a lot about it. And, you know, we had this kind of conversation, and it was awkward because it was in person conversation. And then he goes, and he very politely said, because I think I met him in like, I think it was like August, and at that point we had a sort of November deadline, and he was like, I've booked a flight to Auckland, you know, and I'm going to go and see, you know, I'm pretty sure I've got Dave Dobbin locked in, and I think I'm going to go and meet Jordan Luck. And that was about, you know, that was about as far as I'd got. And he was like, okay, I'd probably suggest that a little bit more, you know, in that nice way that editors do, I'd probably suggest, you know, they're sort of giving you a back massage with one hand, but they've got a knife in the other, and he was like, I'd probably suggest that you just sort of pushed on a little bit. And I was like, yeah. And then they pushed the deadline out, fortunately, for a reason that really didn't have anything much to do with me. Well, probably he went, we're going to need to do it. But he sort of told me that for production reasons, they pushed it out. So I'm being a bit long-winded here. Basically, I didn't write a word of the book until a week after Oscar was born, which was ludicrous. And then, like, I spent a few days holding him and marvelling over the fact that he was alive and a miracle, and had given, you know, given us something to do with our lives, and that everything had been irrelevant up until that point. And then I kind of went, shit, I've got a book to write. You know, and I remember putting on Don't Dream It's Over, which is the first thing in the book, and I put that song on and listened to it for about 3 hours on a loop, which, you know, anyone listening probably thinks that's insane, and that's an act of sort of masochism enough. But Oscar was a week old, and he was sitting next to me in the thing, and I sat on the floor with my laptop and wrote the first chapter of the book. And then, you know, the chapters, I think I wrote the last chapter next, and then, you know, the songs just kind of all, I had my order that I wanted them in, but I just sort of started to sort of pick and choose. But it was an extra, you know, the whole thing was really done in probably just under a couple of months in terms of the writing. and it was done at the, over the Christmas holidays, and we had family in town. They were all doing nice things, and I kept like sort of saying hi to them and then disappearing into my room and sort of trying to write into the night. And so it was nuts, really, but it was a really cool thing to be involved in. And I really felt the whole time that, you know, I'm actually just you know, facilitator of other people's words here. I'm just a sort of conduit or something.
Because that's, I was just going back to, you know, like imagining you as a, you know, sort of teenager or 20-year-old, new to Wellington, going into Unity, buying Stranger Music, and that Bukowski sort of connection and all that. And you wrote poetry, you still write poetry, you write short story. Well, you, I read a poem the other day. But, you know, you write short stories.
Mm.
And then how do you balance this? You know, like, how do you balance the... I mean, do you not see it as any different? Do you see the music writing exactly the same as the fiction? Or how do you...
I think a lot of people would see my music writing as being some kind of fiction.
oh my goodness.
I was talking about this with Katie just the other day, and saying, you know, it's kind of how I operate is kind of chaos, and that's probably really bad, but also I find something quite inspiring about that. There's constant noise in my head, and I'm not alone in this. I'm sure this is sort of the modern condition or something, but the postmodern condition or whatever, the postmodern condition. But I, you know, I write really quickly. I write often and a lot, and I find it quite easy to put something down. Put something down I'm pleased with is obviously a different matter, but I sort of do very much operate in a publish and be damned environment, which is something that I guess journalism has taught me, that you can never really win. And put it out there and see what happens. And then the immediacy and intimacy of online writing has ratcheted that up a gear. So, but yeah, there's this constant noise, you know, that there's a dozen Facebook posts, and then there's, you know, Twitter, and then there's jump over to another Facebook page that I operate, and then there's a blog, and then there's a website, and then there's occasionally some sort of contract writing, and then there's a thought for an idea for a short story or something, and then there's a film that I must watch and five books that I want to read, and that's all going on in my head all the time. And sometimes that's really wonderful, and sometimes that's quite horrifying. And it's usually pretty easy to clear that out, though, to go for a wander, or just decide that one thing is the most important thing to work on. Or, you know, my son comes home from daycare and, you know, he wants to play a game, and that's suddenly far more interesting than whatever shit I was doing. So I don't think there's any great struggle there. But to answer your question, I guess I've started to see less and less of a divide between the things. Yeah. It is all kind of one thing in a way. I have to remind myself of certain kind of conventions. Like, if I haven't written a newspaper review for a while, I have to remember that there is a slight difference between that and a blog.
Mm.
And if I haven't written something, you know, even more formal than a newspaper review, if I'm, you know, doing some sort of essay or whatever. But yeah, I kind of like the idea that a poem is a blog post in this day and age, and a blog post can be a bit of fan fiction, it can be an essay, it can be a review, and you know, when you have to sort of spell it out and justify it to people, you've sort of missed the point yourself, I think.
Mm.
Like, so I just kind of do all these things, and you hope that people are working out and getting what they want from them, and conversing with them and at them, you know, there's a dialogue constantly going on. But you just, you know, most of the poems that I kind of publish, most of them are really old and written long time ago. And occasionally there's a new thing. And what I've started doing is going back through old things and kind of rebuilding them.
Nice. You know, like
I sort of go, that's really clunky, I can fix that. And I quite often make it more clunky. But, you know, at least it's got an element of where I'm at now or something in it. So I used to just write, like, unbelievable amounts of this stuff. And most of it was flat out rubbish. And a lot of it still is. But I have a go at fixing some of it. And I put it up there. And I took poetry quite seriously for a while, and then I think, you know, and I had you know, I used to do a lot of readings and performances, and my high point is I got a poem published in The Listener. It was a long time ago, but you know, that happened, and that was kind of cool. And I put some things in some of the journals, you know, Jam and Spin and those sorts of things when they were around and operating, and I submitted to lots of other things, obviously, like loads of things, and got laughed at, no doubt, and certainly got declined. And I think, like, I kind of, a lot of the poems that I write, I think I'm kind of taking the piss out of poetry a wee bit, and I'm certainly taking the piss out of myself, and sometimes out of the audience if there is one. And again, those things are all one thing. And I just sort of thought, like, I've got this website and I put stuff up. It sort of started, like, I had a couple of poems that I thought were quite interesting comments on music. So and through a different form. So I thought, oh, I'll put those up because it's extending the dialogue. It's a different take on something. And then I just sort of, like, and I don't think I've had any great success at all with publishing the poems, but I'm like, they're mine, and it's a way into the world for them, and some people get something from them, and I obviously get something from it. So that's just kind of happened, and it's a little bit the same with short stories. I wrote a couple that years and years ago. I wrote a small series of short stories, and they all had a tiny little mention of music in them. You know, it wasn't, sometimes it was crucial, other times it wasn't, but there was always a mention of music, even just like making sure I referenced a particular song or band or something, you know, something was playing and that was part of the action, or a character liked a character liked jazz and went home and listened to George Benson or John Coltrane or whatever. And so I started posting those up because I felt, well, this is another version of writing about music in a way, like in some small sense music inspired me to write that. And then I've got more wayward with that with time, and just decided, well, this has got nothing to do with music at all, but it's still writing. And if people are reading what I'm doing, they're reading it because it's writing, you know, and this is, you know, that's what it's got in common. So yeah, that's kind of how it all sort of operates for me.
Because that's something I love about the blog, is that I do feel like that's, I just think that it works really well. Have you got, I find it exceptionally hard to write about music in fiction. Like, I think it's that thing where I always feel embarrassed about my musical tastes, and I always feel embarrassed about how passionate I feel about music. And, you know, like, I don't know, I grew up sort of in the 90s, you know, I had a partner who was a drummer, and I hung out with a lot of people that were kind of, and it always felt like it was something that was cool, but I never seemed to hit that cool. But apart from that, I always find, I was just looking up there the other day at Visit from the Goon Squad, and I was thinking, that largely talks about music by talking about music. Like, you go to this amazing gig, and what it talks about is what's going on in the audience. And I just, like, I was writing a dreadful bit the other day about Expecting to Fly. Like, I really wanted that to be in this thing that I'm writing, and I was writing about soaring guitar. It was just dreadful. Like, what do you think about books that you read about, you know, what do you think?
Well, yeah, I've got a stack of novels and short stories that are about music or music inspired, and a lot of them I haven't read, you know, I haven't quite got to, and some of them is, you know, I have read Visit to the Goon Squad, but there are others that I sort of look at and I go, I really should get to that. And also, obviously, I've still got stacks of bios and autobios and stuff. And I do read a lot of music-related fiction and non-fiction, and I guess write it. But I am quite jealous of people that can just listen to music and not write about it. I'm quite jealous of that because I guess, like, you know what... What's more beautiful, the butterfly going around the garden or the one that someone's sort of tacked into a frame and stuck on the wall? And that's kind of what I do, and that's kind of actually pretty ugly, you know, and so like I'm pinning down a butterfly or whatever and sticking it to the wall and it's there forever, as long as it takes someone to hit F5 anyway. You know, and I'm doing that and it's actually quite ugly. And so when I talk to people that are really knowledgeable and passionate about music, and particularly people that don't really write about it. You know, our mutual friend Carl Schuker is a great example of that because he, you know, I know his fiction, and does include, and he writes, I think, really well about, well, for a start, he writes really well, so full stop. But but he writes really well about music in the context of his fiction. But I don't know that he's ever really, written songs or written about songs in a journalistic sense. And yet, I he's one of the bigger music fans I know, and he's quite obsessive about music and his record collection and the way it operates. And it's very particular, you know. And I'm quite envious of people that my friend Jeremy Taylor, who works at Slowboat, is a bit like that too, in that he's a very good writer and writes very well about a range of things. And he has done some music writing, but he's been smart enough to never go down that, poorly paid, ridiculous,
thankless
wormhole. So, I've had him write a couple of guest blogs for me, and they've been awesome, great. I've recorded a podcast with him that I haven't put up yet, where we just sort of guest bag about music for hours,
nice.
which I must sort of wade into and edit and release. But I am jealous of people that can just dig it, and I always get asked if like writing about it has kind of blunted me in some way, blunted a passion, or you do get a bit jaded in terms of going to shows and stuff, and you do get a bit relaxed about what I miss now, which actually was really good, because you can't do everything and you can't go to everything, and when you've got a kid and you get up early or whatever, you just sort of go, well, that one, I really believe now, I mean, I've seen most of the amazing shows I want to see, which I'm really have been really fortunate to get to see, particularly because I've seen most of them without leaving Wellington, people always say that we don't get that many good concerts here. It's like, without leaving New Zealand, I've seen, Brian Wilson and the Rolling Stones and Paul McCartney and Sonny Rollins, and these are heroes of mine, and Neil Young, and I've seen Bob Dylan three times, and these are people that have been in my record collection for 30 years, and longer, in terms of they were music I grew up with, was raised on, and I've seen them, and in some cases I've interviewed them, and there are hundreds more that I'm, forgetting to name. And there's only a very, very small list of like artists I wish I'd seen. Mm. And in most cases, they are sadly not quite beyond their, relevancy or best point. But I would have preferred, like I've never seen Prince, but I would prefer to have seen Prince 10 or 15 years ago. I would go in a heartbeat if he played in New Zealand tomorrow, and he would still do, everyone raved about the Aussie shows a couple of years ago, and I'm sure they were fantastic, but I still watch bits of the 2004 tour and go, that was the last time to actually see him, that was the transcendent, that would have been like going to church, that would have been like seeing Solomon Burke or Sam Cooke or something like that would have been the version of that. But that, it's such a small list of things that I haven't yet seen, and there is still a chance. So I've been pretty lucky with that, and you just keep trying to. I guess the thing I get frustrated with is you write about stuff, and people, I think, forget. I guess maybe that is why I have tried to focus quite heavily on conversations and dialogues and that kind of structure, that it's ongoing, and that's what I kind of learned quite quickly from immersing myself in the blogging world, because people remember the one thing you wrote about someone and decide that that's your definitive take on it, and that's not the case at all. You move just as they do. Like if a musician writes a record you didn't like and you say so, that's fine, but people don't sort of accept or believe that you might then praise something that they do that they think is wonderful, and that happens all the time. I wrote a really positive review of the second Fat Freddy's Drop album.
Yeah,
if you try to Google it, you can't find it. I don't know what's up with that.
I
didn't like the first album. I didn't like when I saw them. I didn't actually really like the third or fourth album, but the second album has got some magic on it, and I fronted up and said so because I knew I had to, because I'd written about them only a few weeks before the second album came out, and it had gone, kind of gangbusters, and people had sort of all decided that I'd either, called out the Emperor's New Clothes, or that I'd defamed, the greatest musical act to ever happen in New Zealand. It was a bit polarizing, and those are sort of the two camps. And So I was like, no, I have to front up and listen to the new album, and if it's good, I have to say so, and I did. But yeah, it's funny that that's not doesn't seem to be around.
Because I mean, that was one of the surprising things I found about Cohen, is that once I started looking at this book, I realised I've read Beautiful Losers. I have a copy of Flowers to Hitler, and I've got a copy of Energy of Slave.
Yeah.
So I went through this huge Leonard Cohen phase, which I cannot remember. Like, I cannot, obviously, there's something else going on. But, you know, I think I heard So Long, Marianne. I heard, I think I saw Straightjacket Fitz perform it, maybe, or someone performed it.
Yeah, that'd be right.
I got obsessed with that song. I moved on to Cohen. I just, you know, ate it up. And then I feel very embarrassed to say this because... But I tried to listen to a couple of the albums that I loved when I knew we were talking. Yeah. And boy, it's not doing it for me anymore.
I wanted to ask you what you thought of the book and him, and, you know, if it did anything for you, and I got the feeling it didn't.
Well, no, I mean, this is the thing that I find really odd, is that I read... Like, if I hear it sing... Like, I love... This is so embarrassing, but he did the theme for the new True Detective season, and I love that song. Is the album called The Future, or is it just called Future? I love that album.
Yeah, 92?
Yeah. I think. I'm just catching up. Yeah, and, like, the thing is that I would love to go and see him in concert. I've never seen him in concert, which is really embarrassing as well. But there was just something about it... And that's what I found really interesting about the poetry, is my first time through, I read it and I thought, oh, now I remember what I liked about it. It was a bit, there were a lot of naked women and lying in the sun and that kind of, oh, yeah. But the second time I read it through, God, there's some good stuff in there.
Yeah, there is.
There is some fucking great stuff.
And there is, I quickly read it again because I kind of look, you know, I thumb through it once a year or so, and I sort of sped through it because a lot of it is ingrained. And I thought, you know, the wonderful thing I think I get from that book is there are a handful of things in there, maybe two handfuls, that I just don't fucking understand at all. Yeah. And I love that. You know, I don't know what he was on about. And yet most of, you know, to crude, because everyone talks about him being this profound, you know, force as a lyricist and this poet and, you know, this intellectual within pop music. And it's like, actually, everything is about fucking drugs and religion.
Yes.
Everything. That's it. That is his, you know, women, wine and song, fucking drugs and religion. That is it. And there's clearly nothing wrong with that because he does that very well. But it's like, it's kind of not really that profound. And then some of the ways he gets into that, some of the ways he puts it. And I always, I sort of think, I read it and I go, and this is probably a dunce notes version of analysing Cohen. But I read it and go, he's so fucking emo, you know?
Yes.
It's wonderful. Like, he has this, you know, I think it's that thing... you know, and where I make a connection in my reading between the two, where people read Bukowski and go, oh, he's just a misogynistic pig.
Yeah.
It's like, yes he was, and, you know, he certainly wouldn't have been a nice dude to know, but there's a lot of humour in there, and he takes the piss out of himself, and he is aware that he's a cantankerous, drunk asshole. He's aware of it, trades on it, is proud of it, but he's also embarrassed by it. And I think it's similar with Cohen, is that he is very aware of who he is and what he's trying to do, and the oddness about him. And there is a lot of humour in what he writes, you know, and you certainly you get that in his presentation of them as songs and in his banter at concerts. He's very good. And, you know, he does, there's a song off one of the more recent albums, A Thousand Kisses Deep, and he does that as a reading now in concert, and it really works. I think, you know, it's an okay song, but as a reading, it's very good. And it's just, you know, it's really an update of some of those wonderful lines from earlier songs, you know, like, I ache in the places where I used to play, and, you know, and if you want a different kind of lover, I'll wear a mask for you. You know, there's this total playfulness and humour that he's going for, and often quite absurd, but it's framed in this sort of way that, and there's something quite sort of soap opera about Well, there's that poem in there that's only three lines, and I, you know, I should remember the first line because it's the woman's name, but I can't. But it's like, please find me. I am almost 30, you know, whatever her name is. And that's the whole poem. And I always loved that. I mean, it was really funny to me reading that as a teenager and then remembering it when I was coming up to, like, it's been this weird little, it's hardly like a classic Leonard Cohen poem, but it's been this little signpost for me. Yeah. Reading it when I was 13, reading it when I was 19, reading it when I was 21, 25, 30, 35, you know, and on. Mm. I'm like, what does that mean? And it, there's a photo on one of the biographies of it scrawled on a wall. So he, you know, he wrote it on a wall and then turned it into a poem, decided. And I like that about him. You know, there's some lists in there. There's and there's that section where there's the... I can't remember which book it's from originally, but because this book we're talking about is a compilation, you know, of some of those volumes you mentioned, and then obviously it goes through all the albums and puts the lyrics. But there's that bit where there's the prose poems, which are quite intense odd, and a lot of those I find quite baffling in a good way. But then there's the commentary on them, and the commentary is a lot lighter, but also very poetic.
Mm.
In some cases, it's more poetic than the verse. Mm. So yeah, there's I've always sort of feel like there's, it's so simple what he's about, but there's a lot to unpack from it.
Because I think that was, it's interesting you saying coming to it, because I am sure that I have those books because I came to them completely earnestly.
Yeah.
I think it was around the age of sort of 19, 20.
Yeah.
I came to them thinking, I want to write about women like that. I want to write, oh my God. That's, you know, and
probably
I think,
known as the bedsit acoustic guitar age, isn't it? You know,
like, so me. Yeah, it's so me.
Probably bought a stash of Joni Mitchell records around the same time.
Exactly. And like, I think what was,
I can remember reading this in a bedsit with a fucking lava lamp.
Yeah.
On, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and I came to it then, and I think what I'm enjoying more about the new music of his is that I can look at it freshly and start to see the fun and the ridiculousness of it. And I just think, yeah, I think that I took him, it wasn't him that I think my, you know, like trouble with him actually stood in. I think it was revisiting those songs, because like I say, I started right back at the one that has got So Long Marion in it, which might be Songs of Leonard Cohen. Can't remember anyway, but I started right back there and I just got this feeling in my stomach and, you know, like, oh, because I just hadn't listened to it for so long. Whereas I think Tom Waits, in a way, has helped me understand Leonard Cohen, because I came to Tom Waits very late and thought, this guy's fucking hilarious. Then when I hear Cohen, I sort of think, oh, he's hilarious in the same, oh, right, it's not all, you know, you know. And I don't know, like, I mean, and that's what I think's marvellous about that. Like, he's had a hugely long career, hasn't he?
Cohen is, you know, nicely not too prolific as well. And to, you know, like, it's for a sort of heritage artist or whatever you want to call it, you know, a legacy artist, there's not too, there's not too much to have to grab.
Yeah.
You know, like, and yes, you could just get, you know, because if someone tells you, which is actually the complete and utter truth, and I say this as someone who owns every single Bob Dylan recording you can kind of get and a few that you're not supposed to have. there really are, you could get away with having a half dozen Bob Dylan records, and that would give you a read on it, and enough of a read that you would then dip into some others if you wanted to, or go, nah, I'm good. I'm done. But, you know, with Cohen, you know, if you got two or three records, sure, that might cover you, but you can actually, you can get across that whole catalogue quite easily. And I'm always kind of interested in, you know, another guy who I think is, you know, who I think is a great lyricist, but actually his lyrics didn't work very well for me on paper, but I've got a friend who has the book and loves it, is Paul Simon.
Oh.
And I love his lyrics, but I really hear them as, because they're almost like kind of, you know, what's the word, like non sequiturs and stuff, like they're just, they're little idiomatic phrases, and he sort of cobbles together this impressionistic story, and why it works is because it's got this sort of supple bounce underneath it musically, and this intoxicating sort of melody and so forth. But you know, there's a really small finite catalogue of Paul Simon. He's actually managed his solo career remarkably, in that there's only a dozen records for you to, and they're all really rewarding, I think. But and so Cohen's a little bit like that. You know, there's only a kind of small handful of things that that you can hear in total, let alone what you need to hear.
I always had this interesting thing with Cohen as well, is that and it's, you know, all my bullshit, the fact that he started as a poet and then went to music. Yeah. I always feel like it's poetry put to music in a way that, I saw someone talking once, and they were talking about how they wrote a song, and they started off writing the song just with groans and grunts and that kind of thing, and then fitting words around it and that sort of thing. And I feel like, what do you think about that relationship
ask musicians about that, about how, you know, what the writing process, you know, if I'm interviewing someone, I'll often ask them about what the writing process is and how they arrive at it and you know, what comes first. And, you know, there's no one answer, obviously, no one correct answer, but it's very rare that a person has a set of words to marry up to a song. What people do, what I think is quite common, is people will say that they'll arrive at a phrase, you know, a line, they'll have a couplet.
Yeah.
Something I would guess they're probably quite pleased with, you know, like a little couplet or even four lines, you know, and they're quite proud of that as an idea. And then that idea morphs when they create some music and they start doing the thing of just sort of, you know, pronouncing, you know, making utterances into a dictaphone that match the rhythm. And then they kind of go and find words that make sense, that match the rhythm that they've made up. The actual song has gone quite removed from what that original lyrical idea is, but those words are still in there. So, you know, that's kind of a common thing. Or they, you know, you watch that great Metallica documentary, and they're sitting trying to come up with with work. That to me is a wonderful example of you know, I think what's great about that, obviously, that Some Kind of Monster is a really funny, interesting film to watch for many reasons, but there's a beautiful truth about that really ugly scene of watching them try to come up with the shittiest lyrics, because that's really honest, you know. I feel like that is, you know, I've played in a couple of bands that wrote a couple of songs. I've mostly played in covers bands, and but even the covers bands I've been in had a couple of originals, because that's usually what happens. You try, and you know, I remember sitting around in songwriting sessions like that where someone had a riff and they had a, you know, and it wasn't the Layla riff. They actually had their own riff, or they even had a melody. You know, they even had a chord sequence that went somewhere and did something. But then it was like we all sat around. What's this going to be about? And you know, and I, you know, and God, fuck, I shouldn't admit this, but I turned up with a couple of poems, already written poems, and went, "Oh, here you go, we could do this." And we kind of did. Like, great. We kind of took things from it, or I'm not musical enough to shape words into the melody, but I could give words or even try and write lyrics to someone and let them kind of bend them and shape them. And it's kind of worked, but it's fucking embarrassing, you know. Like, you sit there and you're not even doing it for an audience. You're doing it for an audience that's on your side, your band, your peers, and you're all, and you know, if they laugh at your words, it's like, well, come on then, where are yours? And you're in it together, and there are some really, really shitty ideas, you know.
I just can't believe, like, I mean, you know, I just cannot believe, I love working collaboratively, it's one of my favourite things, but I would hate anyone to be around for those first stumbling sentences.
That's like, it. I mean, I was going to say, not many writers really publish their notebooks, do they?
No.
And when they do, it's still, you know,
it's like, whoa. It's,
when they publish their journals and their notebooks, you know, it's still gone through a process of publishing, right? It's still the things, you know, that they've decided they want people in on, you know. It's still been sculpted, and you know, I guess there are some places now with people publishing online where, you know, I thought it was interesting, Everett True, the music writer, he does some quite cool stuff where he'll put up things and put in brackets early draft, and he'll actually, because he's writing an essay about a genre or a style or a period, and he actually wants collaboration. He wants people to give him, to say, what have you missed? And he will hone it, but he'll put, these are my first thoughts on the subject, and here they are.
Yeah.
Now, not only tell me where I've gone wrong, but help me, and then I will include your, and so he's doing that, which I think is really cool.
Yeah.
And, because then the thing is, there's an honesty there where when you read the finished essay that's got everyone's references about everything in there, and you don't just go, wow, that guy's really insightful and he's taking credit for everyone's work. He's showing you the steps. He's going, well, I started here, and then you guys have given me this and I've honed it too. So I find that sort of stuff, you know, there is opportunity for that, but not many people are going to do that.
No,
you know, not many people are gonna.
I won't.
I don't think I would. I mean, I'll rewrite things. I don't really do a lot of rewriting and reposting of things. I'll rewrite early poems and put up the version I want now. But that's because I'm a different person to the you know.
Yeah.
With poetry, it's like, you know, when I was writing a lot of poetry, and I guess at my most serious with it, even though the poems themselves weren't often that serious. But when I was at my most serious in terms of pursuing it as an idea and a thing to do, you know, I was a very different person to who I am now. So it's kind of nice. And I actually had, you know, I guess this is making it sound too important, but I had an epiphany. I was asked, I did these readings with Sam Hunt for a few years on Poetry Day out in Upper Hutt. And I went out and I used to go out and do them, and you know, they went quite well, and you know, and you got paid, which obviously was amazing and working in that area. And you know, I met Sam a bunch of times, and I love Sam and I love what he does. And one time he was very kind to me, and you know, was like, oh, you know, come back to a room and we'll have a drink and we'll have a chat. And he told me he liked a particular poem and could he have it, and I gave it to him, and I was, you know, I was chuffed. And he goes, and brilliant Sam, he goes, oh, you give me some of your words, I'll have to give you a poem too. And he looked through this folder and then just tore out this bit of, you know, typed up, and it was a poem by, I think, Yeats. You know, it wasn't one of his. It was like a poet. He was like, I'll give you a poem too. Here you go. And it was like, it was so cool. I've still got that. But shortly after that, I think like the following year, I went back and I hadn't written a thing. I hadn't read a lot of poetry. I certainly hadn't read any out loud. And I went back and I was doing my stuff. I found it really, really hard to pick the things I was going to even read. And then I was standing up there, and midway through a particular thing, I just went, this is a fucking lie. I don't actually believe this shit. You know, I don't believe, I'm not the person that wrote this. And it was really great for me, because I just went, I'm not going to do this again. Yeah. Like, I might write some stuff again, but I am not going to stand up and recite this shit, because I just do not believe it. And I had a lot of fun with reading that stuff over the years. You know, some of the stuff I think is, particularly in performance, you know, I'm not trying to pat myself on the back for it, but it lends itself to performance. It's bouncy and it's kind of funny, and I'm sort of, as I say, taking the piss out of myself and even the form and stuff, and it's storytelling more than poetry. But I just went, nah, this isn't real. So I stopped doing it, and it was probably one of the smarter career moves I've ever had, you know. just not going to do that.
I'm really interested in I think I'm segueing. But I'm just thinking of you standing up performing, and now often what your job is to be in the audience and then watch someone else, you know, sort of interact with other people's creativity. What do you think, I'm sorry, this is a really huge dumb question, but what do you think is the purpose of a music journalist? Like, what do you think you're doing when you're writing those reviews?
Yeah, it's a good question, because it's changed a lot.
Yeah.
And yeah. I kind of suffer that taunt and comments all the time that, you know, you're irrelevant. And it's like, well, I'm not.
Gee, thanks, guys.
Well, but also it's like, I'm not really, because you came here to tell me. Yeah, that. Like, if I was really irrelevant, you wouldn't have bothered.
Yeah,
like, you wouldn't have seen it. Like,
true.
You know, you can't go around pointing out other people's irrelevancy and feel like that's some powerful currency. Like, you need to stay away from it to prove. You know, silence is the best argument there for someone being irrelevant. Don't interact. So there's that. But also, like, I have tried with reviewing and writing. I have tried to kind of move with the, you know, I'm sure I'm setting myself up here, but I have tried to move with the times of how the process is different. I mean, you know, back in the day, like, what drew me to writing about music was, apart from a love of music and I guess a love of writing, well, absolutely a love of writing, was that, you know, my heroes were not only these musicians, but my heroes were these great music writers, Ian Penman and Sylvie Simmons and Lester Bangs and Nick Kent and, you know, so many others, you know, dozens of really great writers. And I grew up reading their words and books and magazines and then later online. But the thing is, when they were doing what they were doing to begin with, and a lot of those names I mentioned are still doing it, and they've adapted one way or another really well. A lot of them just write books now, say. But, you know, they were getting the music before anyone else.
Yeah, yeah.
And people went to them as a source to find out whether... And so I guess this is really simple, but the main thing that's changed is, you know, I'm not the first to get the music. Mm. And when I started writing about music, I was among the first, you know, like in, say in New Zealand, like... I remember when I started writing reviews for the Dominion, when it was the Evening Post, in fact, you know, I got this pile of shitty CDs to review, and that's how it was sort of put to me. Oh, well, if you want to write for us, you can take all the crappy CDs no one else wants, and, you know, turn up next week with 150 words on a few of them. So I was like, right, fuck you, this is my challenge. And I wrote about all of them, and it was about 30 CDs, and I just... went through them all, and I turned up with a floppy disk of my reviews and drove it into the office and handed it to them. So that's sort of going back. And I remember the thing I really wanted was after a couple of months, I wanted to ask for an album that I might actually, you know, like and be interested in. And I didn't know how to do that because I was like, oh, well, I'm cleaning up the dregs here. I'm on mop-up duty. And that's fine, I've got to earn my stripes. And then I remember going, oh, I hear there's a new Weezer album coming out and I really want it. And it was the green one, like their third album at the time. Good. And I loved the first two so much that I really, and you know, third one's pretty good too. And after that, it's complete diminishing returns with them. But but I wanted to hear that. And I've still got the CD with the giant big sticker of like out in June or something. And I got it in, you know, April or March or something. And I remember thinking, you know, and that's sort of what, 2001 or 2.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, so I was among the first in the country to hear that, say. Obviously, it had gone through all the other channels. But now that just doesn't happen at all. Yeah. I mean, you have to... And so you're writing about music where, you know, kind of from behind. Like, the people that are interested in the stuff you're writing about, there's a good chance they've heard it. There's a good chance they've bought it or they've downloaded it. They've acquired it.
They're already fans.
They've already written about it themselves because they've got their own blogs and that. So I try to kind of like, my thing now is, and this has always kind of been how I've written about music in a way, but my thing now is, you know, I want to kind of announce my response to it. I want to announce, and it's an emotional response, you know, as much as anything. You know, what's the point in naming the fucking songs, you know? And so when I do my reviews on my site, you know, I'll bury in there somewhere a link to the album.
Yeah.
Like I don't want to just go, this is the name of the album and highlight that next to the link. I just sort of, somewhere in there I bury a link because it's like, well, I still want people to read this if they want to read it. But if they want to actually go to the album and see what tracks are on it, hear it, buy it, and they haven't done that already, there's the link. So why do I need to waste time going, it's got 14 songs, you know? There's a side one and a side two because I'm actually reviewing a record. You know, there's no point in any of that. And that's what, you know, you go back and look at music reviews, particularly ones in newspapers where they've got to do 200 words max. It's like the first track starts with blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you do find yourself falling back into that way of describing stuff now and then because there's no rules. But, yeah, it's hard to know what the role is. For me, I guess I continue doing it and have done it all the time because I'm like, well, I want to write about this. And that's really all there is to it. I want to write about this and I want to put my thoughts out there on it. And if people want to read it, they can. And that's why I've always kind of had the attitude that, you know, you should write about as much as often if you can about the music you hate as the music you love, because you've got to show both sides. You've got to, and so, you know, like my favourite music writer in New Zealand, in terms of the guy I think who is the best and the most knowledgeable and the best crafter of it all, as both a speaker and a commenter and as a writer, is Nick Bollinger. There's no question.
Yeah.
Absolutely, he's amazing. But I do think with time, because I know it wasn't always this way, I started reading his stuff in the Listener years ago and thought it was amazing. I do think with time, I get the angle that you just want to recommend things. But with time, I want to hear him sound off about things that he thinks have failed.
Yeah.
And he doesn't do that. Mm. And certainly doesn't do that very often. Mm. Not often enough, I think. But, you know, I get the argument for why you're out there recommending things and you just want to turn people onto good stuff. But in order for people to really know what moves you and what drives you, it's nice to hear what didn't work and the things you don't respond to. So I guess that's what I've always, you know, wanted to do with that.
Because I always wish there was like, yeah, I don't want to get into book reviewing in New Zealand because it depresses me. Yeah. But
I've done a tiny bit of that, yeah, and I've found that to be a strange...
It's such an odd beast, but
yeah.
I always feel like one of the most important things I need to do is say who I am when I do a review, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I think that, you know, so that people can think, oh, she didn't like that, so I'm probably not going to be interested in what she thinks, or da da da. And I think you're right, like, I mean... And I guess the other thing that I always see with your work is that it starts a conversation. That's the other thing about it.
Yeah.
And you are so fucking great. Like, I just love the way on Twitter you will retweet. If someone says something about you that isn't, you know, they disagree. You'll retweet it and with no kind of fucking, you know. And I really like the way it seems to start a conversation. And I know that there's been times that you've written reviews and I've thought... Oh, like, actually, I remember one time I was somewhere and I thought, oh, I hope Simon's not here. I don't think he'll like it.
Oh, good, yeah.
And I just...
And then I was and I slammed it? Or?
Well, no, you were really good. I thought it was a great review of the thing that I was at. But, you know, I just think that it's
Nico
great.
Case?
No, it wasn't Nico Case, it was Cat Power, I think.
Oh, right, yeah.
And I thought that was a really bloody good review.
Okay.
And, but I think... that what you're doing is awesome is basically what I'm saying. Like, because I do feel that we do a lot of that in the book world because it's so small. We kind of mealy mouth around, and often you're reading a review, kind of thinking, are they saying
this? There's this weird thing that happens where people feel threatened by a voice that's gone into print. You know, they just feel they just decide what you know. I always get what gives you the right. You know what? And I was like, I'm kind of like nothing does. I decided I wanted to do it. You know, that's it. Like, I don't need to, you know, I don't need to list my credentials, which is great because I've got fuck all. But I don't need to list my credentials all the time. You know, like, I don't need to tell you how many records I've got or listen to. If you've been reading for ages, you'll arrive at some version of that if you want to.
Yeah,
you can. You know, it's all there. The work's all there, and if you want to look through it, I wouldn't wish it upon anyone to read everything I've done because it's fucking it's ludicrous. There's too much. But if they want to do that, then they can find some version of me. But the thing that's great with doing stuff like this is as much as I've kind of probably sat here and effectively slandered myself, you know, it's really fun to do this sort of stuff because it is a different version of doing that voice. And like you, you know, I've become very attracted to podcasting. Like, I've interviewed people for years, but my process with interviewing was always, and I still do it, but my process with more formal interviews has always been sit on the phone and listen. I don't record them, I just take some notes, and then I want to I don't do the whole question answer transcribe, because I remember talking to some music journalist recently and I said, oh, you know, about his interviews, and he was like, yeah, no, I just do the interview and then I just give the tape to someone to type up the transcriber. And I was kind of like, okay, I get that there are deadlines and I get that you're promoting things, but what about that is fucking writing? That's not writing.
Yeah.
You know, so I always want to kind of shape. And the last phone interview I did was with Joan Baez.
Awesome.
And I, you know, I was stoked to be able to do that one. And so I wanted to experiment, so I wanted to record that one. And then I just sat with the tape, listened to the recording, and wrote it up.
Yeah.
But I still wanted, and it was really good. I enjoyed having her voice there and being able to like directly quote and so forth. But I you know, I still wanted to shape it into my version of the because it's my version of what happened. It's my I'm recalling the conversation. But doing stuff like this, actually just going and talking to people and being a bit more informal about it, and I've been doing that with my podcast and just trying to get different people, and I will hold you to returning the favor, and we'll do this again on my podcast at some point. I just need to read your books because
I'm not very interesting.
No, I know this is
I can talk to you more about Bonnie Tyler.
Well, that would be cool. I know this is all getting a bit backpanning, but like I've told you this already, the short stories of yours are read. I love. I just haven't finished the whole book, but and I need to read your novel as well, but. Because that's the thing, you can get away with, you actually have to, you can get away with talking to musicians without hearing too much of their music, and you actually have to. People don't realise that, you know, we're at the arse end of the world, and we used to get these, we get these interviews sent to us, like requests. People are so rude, they email you and go, you're supposed to fall over yourself that you're going to talk to some chump in a band. They go, hey, great news. The email, great news. You know, it's like the lottery. It is like the lottery. It is like the, you know, just send in $1 million and you could maybe win $2 million. It's like that. And you just need to collect 15 stamps, you know. They send you this email on a Thursday morning. Great news. We've got some interview time today with, you know, the bassist from, you know, blah blah blah, and it's in an hour. Would you like to do it? And it's like, well, I don't know who this person is, and I've got no time to listen to their music. Why should I? You know, you don't get so when you turn around an interview, and you turn it around overnight, say, and people go, oh, that wasn't very good. It's like they think that you had a month to prepare for it,
and it was the only thing you were doing,
and you sat down with the person. So look, sometimes that's amazing. I got this phone call. You know, I never turn it down when it's someone call. I got this phone call. I was working, you know, my day job when I had one. I was working, and I got a phone call from the newspaper. Hey, look, we've just been offered an interview, and it's in an hour and a half's time. Do you want to do it? And I said, oh, better be good. And he's like, no, it is. I can't do it, and I've called you because I think you can do it. It's with John Paul Jones from Led Zeppelin. And I was like, fuck yes.
Yes,
you know, and the timing was, you know, I could actually justify doing it on a lunch break and stuff, and it was a 20-minute interview, and it's like, well, I'm not going to turn that down. And, you know, I've listened to, it was when he was touring with them, Crooked Vultures, but, you know, I knew that album, and I obviously knew his Led Zeppelin stuff and his other stuff, and it's like, I'm not going to turn that down.
Yeah.
So you can go and do, but that's the whole thing, is that I've, in a sense, I've worked my whole life informally towards that interview. You know, I've done the work.
Yeah.
I've been listening to that guy's stuff. I've been reading about him. I've been watching the clips, and I feel I can have a conversation with that guy. And so that's the work no one really sees.
Yeah.
But doing this sort of stuff and doing these kind of informal interviews are great. And I've enjoyed talking to other people and finding out what they do. And my friend John said to me, he heard me talking on the radio recently, and he sent me a really nice compliment. He said, which I thought, you know, the only reason I'm mentioning this, I would normally not be so desperate to plug something someone's saying, but he had a really good point, I thought. He said you work really well on the radio because you don't come across as being like, I'm right about things.
Yeah.
And he goes, and there is a, you know, he said I'm not saying you do that in your print, but I can see how people arrive at that. And that's, I'm just going back to what I said about, you know, 3 hours ago, about like people feel threatened by seeing a voice in print, and they hold you to it. I said that earlier, it's that definitive take.
Mm.
You said this about Leonard Cohen once, so you must always think that.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I went to the Leonard Cohen concert and was blown away by it. You know, the first time he played here of recent years, the sort of comeback thing, I thought it was amazing. Yeah. But, you know, I went and saw the exact same show 9 months later, and some people still got something from that, but I didn't, because he used the exact same banter, the same songs in essentially the same order, the same band. It was, obviously it wasn't crap, they were very good, but I, you know, it took away, in some ways I wish I hadn't gone, I sort of got, I was asked to, and I had to write about it, and so I conveyed that sort of version of the events, but it's like, that's the downside too of it, of, because it's like, what I wrote about that first time, and I sort of declared it the greatest gig I've ever seen, was I was trying to tap into not just my feelings that time, but there was this vibe in the room.
Yeah.
I since talked to a couple of people that left early and hated it, you know, which is which is great. Like, you know, they're entitled to their opinion, and they used foot power and they strolled, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know what they hoped to get from Leonard Cohen. You know, some of them said they didn't like the band, and it's like, who goes to Leonard Cohen for the band? You know, that's a byproduct. They're a very good band, and they serve his songs well. But you are, I think that's the thing with Cohen, and that's what he's always put across, is that you are going to him to hear the words.
Yeah.
You know, no matter, there are some, I mean, there's some mind-blowing performances of him in the 70s with like these incredible bands, because he's always had that very European sensibility about, you know, the sort of European version of jazz and Arabic textures and really interesting sort of world music, I guess, for want of a term, world music flavors. He traveled with an oud player. You know, who does that?
Why not?
You know, like, but it sounds amazing. But you're still going there because of what he's saying.
Yeah,
you know.
Oh, he's great. Hey, thank you.
Awesome.
You're awesome.
It was great to chat.
What's okay? Top of the head, Leonard Cohen song. Favorite Leonard Cohen song.
Well.
There you go.
Yeah, it's impossible to name a favourite, but because I was just, what I had in mind when I was saying that there were some great performances is 1979, there's an album called Field Commander Cohen, The Tour of 79. Yep. It didn't come out until the early 2000s.
Mm.
And there is a performance on there of a song called Lover, Lover, Lover. And I think that is an extraordinary performance that shows how his words worked around a really great musical arrangement and really great playing.
Awesome.
So, given I was just sort of trying to talk about that, that would be the example.
That's the example. Hey, yeah. Thank you so much for coming over.
No worries, it's great.
You're awesome, thank you.
Thank you.